Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. This conversation is so important with David Kostin of Goldman Sachs that we're going to get right to it. All three of us are really curious about his nuance. Why is that? In April, he got it right. He made a call. Forget about another bottom. The gloom crew tore him to shreds, and Kostin went long. And there's been a nuanced Goldman Sachs view forward through this tumultuous 2020. David Kostin, thank you so much for joining. Just simple, now what?
Now what? Well, this year has been about the medical situation. It at the core of the challenge is medicine. And so if you think about what the super forecasting project at the University of Pennsylvania is showing, they have a estimate every day of what the likelihood that there'll be 25 million doses of an FDA approved vaccine somewhere in the next 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, various points in time. The reason I mention that, Tom, is because if you look at where we were in July, middle of July, it was reading 16% likelihood that there would be a vaccine widely distributed between October of this year and April of next year. Okay, 16%. That ran up to 70% by the first week of September. And the market, the stock market, went up around 11%. So you check your numbers, that's around 11%. However, that probability has since turned around and it's gone from 70 down to 50%, 52% this morning. And that likelihood has corresponded with a decline in the S&P 500 by around nearly 10%. So my kind of message to you is that basically we have been trading the likelihood of a vaccine, and you can see that in the data.
And John, I just want to mention, this is Phil Tetlock at the University of Pennsylvania with his wonderful book, Super Forecasting. John?
And David, you were looking at the benchmark compared to the probability of getting a vaccine. Can you go beneath the benchmark? Because you put out some research on this recently, and I think it's really quite interesting. Can you build on it for us, David?
Sure. So I'd say the fundamentals, there's a couple of key debates that are going on with the investor community right now. One is relating to yield curve and inflation and where the rate interest rate market will be. But another one at the core of that is about growth versus value and where should one be. And the core argument is that that people behind the value story would say that, gee, when there's a vaccine that's developed, when and if that takes place, that will allow the acceleration of the normalization of economic activity. And that means the companies and the industries and the sectors that are more cyclical will rebound and do better. That's sort of the narrative behind why to own cyclicals. Now, I would reject that or say that there's a better approach, that the gap in valuation is so significant, it's value, not necessarily cyclicals, that is the better place to be. So that's the first observation. You want to be in value as opposed to necessarily cyclicals. And then the question is, what's the investment horizon? So tactically, value maybe is attractive right now. No question about that. One of the more attractive times to see value over the last 20 years. But ultimately, if you're looking for a longer term story, the secular growth companies, the ones that have actually generated revenue growth and earnings growth despite the pandemic. If we look at what happened in the second quarter and the third quarter, looking out. So the way you want to think about this is, if you go in the entire market, how many companies are able to consistently deliver double-digit revenue growth? Well, the answer is you start looking at who's generated revenue growth in 2018 and 2019. We'll skip over this year for a minute. Expected for 2021, 2022. Let's get a five-year compound annual growth. It'll pick up this year. So that five-year period, only 21 stocks are expected, you know, have been delivering and are expected to do so. So that, I think, is an important argument. So I think there's a two-pronged way to approach the market, tactically value, but ultimately it's about growth. And the secular growth stories, I think, are likely to be winners for portfolio managers if you look out 12 months from now.
David, two parts to the argument that you just laid out. Let's get to the second part in just a moment and pick out the first part. Just give us a little 101. The distinction between value and cyclicals, what is that right now?
So it's an excellent question, Jonathan. It is the idea, most people conflate those two and they think about cyclical stocks that are necessarily sort of industrial would be a classic example. Financial stocks, often interest rate sensitive, or view basically cyclical move with the economy. And that's true. But then when we think about that, those are factually true. We can look at a correlation. You say, well, gee, is economic data getting better? What sectors and stocks tend to do better in that kind of environment? Those would be defined as cyclical, sort of high correlation with economic activity. But value is about what is the market trading. And so you can look at multiples and PE multiples or earnings yields or different ways of thinking about valuation. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're economically sensitive. And so the message, Jonathan, kind of that first part is we want to find lower multiple companies. Valuation, they aren't necessarily cyclical sensitivity. For example, you look at the financials, be challenging in a flat yield curve environment to actually deliver on better growth, slim net interest margins, big reserves because of potential loan losses, difficulty to, under the CCAR proposals, whether the bank financials can pay dividends or buy back stock. So those are some of the headwinds. So those are classically cyclical areas of the market, but it wouldn't necessarily screen as attractive on a valuation basis. That's an example.
David, just broadening out, you still reasserted your call for 3,600 on the S&P at year end less than 2 weeks ago. If we don't get fiscal support in Washington, do you still affirm your 3,600 forecast?
Lisa, the answer is yes. 3,600 is a target for end of the year, 3,800 middle of next year. And the argument I said at the very beginning, ultimately, this is a medical situation, medical challenge for the economy, for society, and ultimately for the equity markets. And I pointed out that the level of the market at the broad level has really been trading pretty carefully, pretty closely with the probability of a vaccine being introduced. So part of the assumption that I'm making is that there will be a vaccine that's identified, probably what most portfolio managers are expecting and what some of the forecasters are projecting is perhaps in October, maybe approved by the FDA at the end of the year and be widely distributed in the first 6 months of next year. The market, as you know, Lisa, is forward-looking, and so they'll start to discount that back. And a few weeks ago, with a 70% likelihood that it was going to be a vaccine available by the end of the first quarter, stock market was pretty close to our target. And now it's obviously pulled back. I think that's a little less probable in terms of the data. So 3,600 remains it. I don't think it's as essential from a fundamental point of view. We want to see the resolution in Washington.
David, John Farrell loaded the boat on Apple and Amazon a long time ago. That's why he's in London. He's looking at 4,000 square feet in Notting Hill, which is great. But what do you do on a relative or absolute basis if you want to rebalance out of a tech overload? I mean, how do you approach the institutional or retail account, the high net worth account that says, look, I've made a success of it, like Faro. What do I do? How do I move out of it? How do you lighten up intelligently?
So it is an absolute essential issue that many growth portfolio managers are grappling with. And the issue is as follows. That when you look at the Russell 1000 growth index, the top five stocks, those five stocks are about 25% of the equity cap of the S&P 500, but they're 39% of the Russell 1000 growth. So a lot of growth managers are actually in passive violation, out of compliance with the SEC guidelines of what makes a diversified mutual fund, because they have too great a concentration in some of those positions. So the answer that I was sort of providing to you and that framework is looking at which companies can emulate from a earnings, from a revenue, from a sales growth point of view, can emulate those big stocks that you were just mentioning, some of the big tech stocks. And there's not that many, but you can think about Vertex, you can think about PayPal, you can see Intuitive Surgical. There's a variety of companies that have delivered on 10% revenue growth the last several years and are projected to do so, in some cases have wide moats around their businesses. And when I work with the analysts at Goldman, these are some of the stocks that we screen as a strategist. And then also that corresponds with the fundamental analysis of the companies. And so the answer, Tom, is that's a way of substituting for some of those large cap growth companies. Those growth companies will still do well, but these are companies that are maybe more middle sized or sort of in the ranking order, maybe number 71 or 73, 75. You know, they can move up the ranking to be one of the larger stocks, and that leads to outperformance. And Tom, that's how I'd combat that, tackle that problem.
Yeah. David, it's good to hear from you. As always, send our best to the team. David Costin there, Goldman Sachs Chief Equity Strategist.
This is the conversation of the day on fixed income. Kathy Jones is a Schwab Center for Financial Research. And what's important here is she's got a wonderful visibility on the challenges individual investors are having in bonds. Kathy Jones, where did the 60-40 portfolio go?
Yeah, a lot of people have tried to abandon it in hopes of getting more income, getting more safety, getting more diversification. But I really don't think it's disappeared entirely. I think it just has to be more nuanced on the fixed income side. So if you look at rolling correlations over the last 6 months or 5 years, you're still getting diversification from treasuries and, you know, higher quality bonds. It's just the upside is much more limited and the magnitude of those changes is much smaller.
What's the elasticity on the downside? If we get yield up and price down, what could be the magnitude of that price down?
Yeah, I'm looking at, if I look at the 10-year treasury and we get a move up in yield this year or into next year, I'd say maybe 95 basis points to 1%. I don't think we get much more than that on the upside. On the downside, you might get down to about 45 basis points or so, or even less, I suppose, in a real negative scenario. So it isn't the kind of move you used to see, 6 to 10 basis points a day on a big down day in treasuries. I mean, in the stock market, you're not seeing that in treasuries now. It's a much more limited move.
In fact, yields higher in the last 24 hours by a basis point with a 2-3% move in the equity market. Kathy, so many people in stocks have been queuing off what's happened with real yields. Can you just unpack that for us a little bit, what you're seeing at the moment?
Yeah, you know, the Fed is holding nominal rates very steady between their zero policy, their forward guidance that it's going to stay there for a long time. And what we've seen, though, is inflation expectations come up. So the real yield has come down to about, you know, negative 1% on the 10-year treasury. And that gives you very limited choices in terms of where you invest your money in the fixed income market. But it does work for the Fed because it makes the hurdle rate for investments very low. It encourages people to borrow, spend, and invest. And that's really what the Fed is trying to get the economy to do.
The rate side of the story anchored. I'm just wondering, Kathy, I'm trying to work out where you think inflation expectations are going to turn and whether we could actually see real yields get less negative because inflation expectations come in, given what we're seeing worldwide at the moment. Any thoughts on that, on how things are developing, Kathy?
Yeah, my biggest fear in the U.S., and now it extends to Europe because of another round of outbreaks of the coronavirus, my biggest concern is we don't get fiscal stimulus, the economy slows down again. Worst case scenario is a double dip recession. It's not our base case, but it's a worst case scenario, particularly if we would start to see a resurgence in virus cases here as well. So I think we're walking a fine line right now. Our base case is still for continued improvement in the economy. But without the fiscal stimulus, and if we were to see more virus cases, we could double dip into a recession in the next 6 months or so.
What's the playbook? What's the haven in that scenario if there isn't that much lower the 10-year yields can go? It used to be investment grade credit, and yet we've seen outflows and a little bit of underperformance there. What is it now?
Yeah, I still think it's treasuries. I you're not going to get as much as you did in the past out of that trade, but it's still treasuries. And keep in mind, I guess in a very negative scenario, nominal yields can go negative at the long end. It probably would force the Fed to take much more aggressive action, but it's not without precedent. If you look at Europe, that's happened.
What about with riskier credit? We've seen some pretty big outflows from high-yield bond funds of late. Is this the beginning of a larger trend?
You know, I think the market needs some correction in high yield. It's gotten very frothy. Some of the junkiest of the junk has rallied quite a bit. I don't think that we're going to see investors abandon it because you do get positive carry. You're going to get a yield that's, you know, 5-6% in high yield, and that's tough to get. So I think you'll see people come back in, barring another recession. But it did get overdone. Spreads were very tight, and the again, the lowest of the low started to do well.
You mentioned a couple questions ago, Kathy Jones, this idea of what the Fed wants, which is completely removed from the coupon given duration that the individual investor wants. And we spoke with Richard Clarity yesterday. It was a complete class act. Great. But does he or the people around him, do they actually care about financial repression?
I would say no. I think they look at the policy of the Fed as being better for the greater good, and that that's not going to change their policy. They think that savers and investors, although we hear a lot of complaints about low interest rates, they think savers and investors are benefiting from the rise in risk assets, and their focus is really on unemployment.
John Farrell, I think this is just an absolutely fundamental condition. We trot out in our fancy suits and ties and talk all this theoretic mumbo-jumbo why retirees and others are getting absolutely crushed well over a decade.
Kathy, this is really important, that these interest rates have been low for a long, long time, not just in the United States, but also in Europe. And the lower they've gone in places like Europe and Japan, they've never gone back up again. Kathy, do you worry about the same thing happening in America?
Yeah. One of the biggest fears we have is something like Japanification, where we get stuck in a deflationary or a very low inflationary environment, and there's not much more monetary policy can do. Again, it's not our base case scenario. We think that we're actually starting to see the economy do a little bit better. I'm relatively optimistic that we can get the virus under control, that it will continue to recover. But it is a worst case scenario, and you can't rule it out. I mean, there's a probability there. Maybe it's a low probability. Maybe it's 5 or 10%, but it exists.
Kathy, I can tell that I'm going to have a long morning with Tom Keene this morning, and you can make it a whole lot better if you turned around and just played a little tune on that piano
for
us.
Wait, seriously,
because
Tom?
Because I know you play. The microphone's going to work. If you can just, please, it would make my day.
It would.
John, you can see,
on that piano.
She's got, I can see over on the left, John, on Bloomberg Radio, her beautiful piano behind her, folks. And over on the left side, you can see she's got her One Direction book.
Okay, I can just see the wheels
on,
turning in her head, saying,
Kathy,
I will never do this show again.
We've got a couple of minutes, Kathy. This is going to work. The piano's right by the microphone.
Next time, I'll play Claire de Lune for Lisa, I promise.
Thank you.
For Lisa, not for Tom or me. I like
me.
That. Kathy Jones.
I love what Nickelback did with Claire de Lune.
That right there describes our relationship with every guest that comes on this program. I'll do it for Lisa, but not for you guys. Kathy, it's good to see you.
Yeah.
Stay well.
Kathy, thank you so much.
Kathy Jones, thank you.
Cowen has provided real leadership in Washington with piecing together a really smart group linking policy into reality. Chris Krueger's provided leadership there with the Cowen Washington Research Group, and he joins us right now. Chris, I got eight ways to go here, but there's a point where there's a belief in salvation by Capitol Hill. Mark your calendar. When do we see salvation from Capitol Hill?
Not this year. So 40 days to election day, when hopefully we'll know the outcome of the election. But even before the tragic passing of Justice Ginsburg, the phase four fiscal talks, the $2 trillion sort of fiscal lifeline for the economy was really hanging by a thread. And now, with the continuing resolution having passed the House, which will keep the government from shutting down next week, you've really lost your last must-pass bill to get a fiscal package done.
I say this, Chris Krueger, with great respect for all the people working in Washington on policy. This debate that we're going to see on Tuesday, is your world removed from it? Is it just going to be a debate about our culture wars, about the great differences between Mr. Biden and the president?
Well, so Chris Wallace is moderating from Cleveland on Tuesday night. He's announced six of the topics.
Yep.
And, two of the topics involve the Supreme Court and, whether or not the candidates are going to agree to the election results. So, you know, at least a third of the debate is going to be deeply controversial.
For nearly 4 years, Chris, the abnormal has become normal. Yesterday, President Trump refusing to confirm a peaceful transfer of power should Joe Biden win the ballots. What kind of abnormal should we be girding ourselves for from November to December?
I would even say November to January 20th, when the Constitution would end the term of president and vice president. A few things, you know, I don't think people should be terribly surprised about this. I mean, recall in 2016 when Trump won the presidency in the Electoral College, losing the popular vote, he then established a commission on voter fraud. Combine that with his views on mail-in ballots over the past 6 months, and this is a pretty, obvious outcome to where we are. When you look at some of the hard and fast dates as laid out by the Constitution, the first one is December 8th. That's when the states must make their final decision on any controversies around the appointments of their electors. So there are really no sort of hard catalysts between November 3rd and December 8th. Hopefully we'll know the outcome of the election on election night, but with the amount of mail-in ballots it may not be election night, it could be election month.
Chris, let's talk about that and what this could mean for financial markets. That's something the market is pricing, it's braced for. You see that in the volatility curve. We talk about that often on this program. Chris, I just wonder, as you look at the polls right now, does it scream tight race to you from what you look at?
I think what is the real key here is going to be the margin of the Senate. Because for investors, for markets, you know, a 50-50 Senate is very different than a 55 Democrats in the Senate, or even a Republican Senate. So I think looking at the Senate margin is really going to be critical, and would point out, too, that a number of the Senate races could come down to recounts. And you have two likely runoffs in Georgia, which won't happen until January 4th or 5th. Reminder that the Florida recount in 2000 took 32 days, something like that. And the Minnesota Senate race in 2008, which was the crucial 60th seat for Democrats, took over 6 months. So, it's not just the presidential race. I think Senate recounts and Senate runoffs are something to keep in mind as well.
Chris, to build on what John is talking about, a lot of people taking a look at the polls saying it's a very close race, even though former Vice President Joe Biden has come out ahead. Are you taking any messages from the polls that perhaps is different than what is commonly believed?
Well, you have the national polls and you have the battleground state polls. Despite all that has happened over the past 6 months, the pandemic, the recession, social protests, et cetera, the presidential race within the national polls is somewhat remarkable in that it doesn't really move that much. Some of the battleground states, we have seen some tightening, the storyline thus far has been that Joe Biden has had a pretty durable, consistent lead. You know, the big question will be, are the polls correct? The national polls in 2016 were pretty good. I mean, Hillary, you know, I think it was about a 300 basis point advantage for Hillary. She won by, you know, call it 2.5. So, you know, some of those state polls are really going to be key. And that's why you're seeing, you know, the overwhelming focus on states like Florida, North Carolina, Arizona, and obviously the three Rust Belt states.
Hey, Chris, great to catch up. Thanks for coming on the show this morning. Chris Krueger there, Cowen Washington Research Group policy analyst.
Right now, Ethan Harris joins us. DeSay's head of Bank of America Economics barely describes his contribution over the years, not only his informed book on Ben Bernanke, but also bringing concision to the study out of Clark University in Columbia. Dr. Harris, thrilled to have you with us today. There's a lot of moving parts here, Ethan. Michelle Myers aged over this studying this labor economy. What is the moving part that matters to Ethan Harris?
Well, I think you guys just talked about it. I mean, the problem right now is that the lagged effects in the economy are still playing out. I mean, recessions always start with some kind of shock. And then as the pain kind of builds, you get these second round effects. And so having jobless claims, even if they're mismeasured at this level, is quite disturbing. And it's a indicator of the pain that's still out there. And it's consistent with the idea that, you know, we're getting past the phase where, you know, we're kind of rebounding from that shutdown and now more into the grinding forward phase with this massive headwind from the labor market. So we don't have to torture the data. The data is torturing us.
Well put, Ethan Harris. I think a lot of people would agree with that as well. Ethan, forgive me just for a moment. I want to talk about the equity market briefly. Tom, a little bit of a slip here on the S&P 500,
yes.
Down 0.8% now. NASDAQ 100 breaking down by about 1.28%. So still the underperformance in tech. You talked about the bid into the bond market. I agree with you. It's subtle, but it's there. On a 10-year treasury, this is where things stand right now. Yields come in just a single basis point. We're down 2 basis points. On a 30-year. So just a bit of a breakdown in this market. And Ethan, a couple of reasons for this breakdown in this market. And it all started over the weekend. The idea that because of the division down in Washington, we don't get a fiscal agreement. In Europe, the idea because of more restrictions on the economies like the UK, France and elsewhere, that we have a more pronounced slowdown in Europe, maybe even, and let's hope this isn't the case, a double dip recession. Ethan, how do you view things right now with those two issues front and center for this market?
Right. So I think when you look at the equity market, you need to think about two different stories here. One is there's a bit of a re-rating in the market as investors realize that we're in a low interest rate environment forever going forward. And so the return on risk assets should be higher in a permanently low rate environment. So the recovery in the equity market, I think, reflects that. It reflects the fiscal stimulus, it reflects the Fed and this kind of low rate environment. But now we're entering a period of tremendous uncertainty. The fiscal stimulus is steadily fading. It peaked in the second quarter, and every quarter going forward, the money continues to run out. And I've actually been surprised we haven't slowed down more than this by now. The fiscal package is basically dead now with this battle over the Supreme Court. And even after the election, we may not get a package. So we're kind of removing the patient from the intensive care unit too early here. And then you layer on top of that the fact that there's this kind of trade war stuff brewing. You have a likely re-escalation of COVID cases in the fall as people move indoors. And then you got things like Brexit in the UK. So it's, I think the market's simply got too many uncertainties on its plate, and it's going to be under pressure for a while here.
Well, given the uncertainties, Ethan, what are the indicators you're watching to indicate a true slowdown that could potentially create the backdrop for a double dip recession?
Well, I think that one of the challenges right now is that we're all kind of, we've got a cottage industry of daily indicators we're all using, including the B of A card data, the home base and all that other, all the other stuff. None of these indicators have really been stress tested through a period to see how accurate they are. They're useful. They're certain. I think they're, all this data is very useful, but the data were a bit misleading in the summer. The daily indicators were weaker than the official statistics. I think we need confirmation from the official data. We need to see hints that the slowdown in retail sales is accumulating into something much weaker. Need to see evidence from the jobs report and so on. So while these timely data are, you know, we all look at them very closely,
right.
We need to get some confirmation from the hard data.
Futures deteriorate negative 29. We're out of stick big, almost 2 points on the VIX, 30.47 right now. Ethan, one final question here. We've got to get back to the markets. Dr. Harris, this morning, the Chancellor of the Exchequer talks about a United Kingdom permanent adjustment. Do you and your team just assume there will be an American permanent adjustment?
There's a structural damage to these economies. I think we can recover largely back to where we started from. But, you know, there's fundamental changes going on. There's been some good things. I mean, we've learned that we can do things more cost effectively, for example, me working from home. But there's also a lot of damage out there. So, yeah, there's a structural component to this whole crisis.
Ethan, good to see you. You look well. Send our best to the team. Ethan Harris there, Bank of America Securities, head of Global Economic Research.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.